Welcome to PR360, where every week the brightest minds in public relations, communications, and media discuss the topics and trends you need to know about. PR360 was produced in partnership with Global Results Communications. Now here's your host, Todd Perry.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for listening to PR360, and we're back with today's guest, which is Megan Prock-McGrath, a strategic communications professional with more than 15 years of experience. In her role as managing director at McDougal, she provides clients with corporate communications counsel and media relations expertise to help them meet their business goals and elevate their voices in the industry. She has a passion for healthcare solutions that are solving today's pressing problems, particularly those designed to lower costs, improve care, and serve vulnerable populations. Prior to McDougal, she was the Director of Public Relations and Communications at Iora Health and the Director of Communications at the Harvard Medical School Center for Primary Care. Megan was a founding member of the Harvard Medical School LGBT Advisory Committee. And welcome to the show. Is there anything we've missed?
That's pretty good list there.
Good, good. You know, sometimes it sounds a little bit like title soup to the listener, but if anything, it lets everybody know that we have somebody very qualified to talk about healthcare and PR today. So I guess I want to start with kind of the big story out of healthcare the last couple of years. I don't know. Hope everybody remembers the COVID-19 pandemic, but how has the landscape changed for communicating about biotech after the pandemic?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I don't know that any of us could have forgotten about it. I would say baseline, more people know about our work. More people have somewhat of an understanding of the drug development process and what it takes to bring a drug to market. The biotech industry has also experienced a great deal of change since the introduction of COVID-19, which, of course, impacts the way we communicate about the work we do. There was a huge surge in investments and interest around COVID. In fact, in 2021, the biotech industry saw more than 150 companies have initial public offerings. Now, for comparison, in 2022, there were 22, and last year there were 19. So that was a huge glut of investment that was put into the industry. More recently, as those other numbers show you, we've experienced a right sizing, which has led to this protracted bear market that we've been in for some time. So each of these forces impact the way that we communicate about our work, whether it be how investors are thinking about the industry and what a bear market means for their portfolio companies and where they're looking to put their money, or patients that now have an increasing understanding of the drug development process. Depending on the type of company, what stage they're in, what their key audiences are, each of these impact our communications in different ways.
Let's see. In the post-COVID world, is the general public better informed about how new medications come to market, like FDA approvals, clinical trials, etc., or have the waters been muddied by everybody becoming an armchair expert on these types of approval processes?
I think it's a little bit of both, actually. I think people have a better understanding of what a clinical trial might look like, what's necessary for it, what the FDA approval process is, the hearings and the reviews that are necessary to actually get that approval. But I think the expectations of the general public aren't quite right yet. Mm-hmm. You think about the fact that the Moderna vaccine was approved on December 11th, 2022. That is less than a year in development. That's an absolutely incredible feat to develop a vaccine in under 1 year that most people don't realize. It does a disservice to the public understanding of what it takes to bring a drug to market, in that 90% of drugs fail. And the average timeline is 10 to 15 years for the successful ones to progress from the bench where the science is developed to the bedside where the patient is. So while people have some understanding, the COVID vaccine was such a tremendous display of what the industry can do that it's a little bit confused people as to what is possible for most drug development processes.
Yeah, because, you know, as someone like myself whose knowledge of this industry goes about as far as the shelf at Rite Aid, when I hear like, oh, this mRNA vaccine is coming out that's going to, you know, prevent cancer, and there's this, and I'm like, okay, is that coming out next week or, you know, but it's just way down the line, right?
Right, yeah. So the little education, the drug development process looks like a number of years of preclinical studies where you get together a packet of information to show your proof of concept that you send to the FDA with an IND, which is an investigating a new drug application. The FDA looks at that, gives you approval, and then there are three phases of clinical trials. It's a small phase just to make sure that there's safety and tolerability and that this is safe to put in humans. And then there's one where you look at actual efficacy. And then your phase three is when you get to the more generalizable, larger audiences. And some of those trials take 1 to 2 years each. So yeah, it's a very long, expensive process to actually get from one step to the next.
Right. Switch over to clinical trials for a moment. I have a bit of a background in direct response copywriting. So we were often trying, you know, obviously to get people to motivate people to take action. Occasionally we do type of thing for a drug company where it was, you know, we're looking for clinical trials, people of XYZ age. What type of messaging works when you're getting people to sign up for a clinical trial for something? What is the appeal that gets people to go, oh, I want to be a part of that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think coming at it from a copywriting perspective is really interesting as well. And what is that call to action? And I think, unfortunately, like so many things in this industry, the answer is that it depends. It's really about knowing your audience. I think we talk a lot about patient-centric drug design and creating with patients, not for patients. I think forming those very close partnerships with patients help tell you what they will respond to. And each patient community is vastly different. Mm-hmm. Their caregivers and their family members and the patients themselves all have their own needs. And so understanding what those needs and wishes are and what their hurdles to receiving care and the hurdles to getting to the clinical trials, if there's mobility concerns, all of those types of things are really important when you're thinking about your clinical trial design as well as your messaging for it. But there are some general best practices that I like to recommend, which is you want to write the materials that resonate with your audience. So based on what they're actually seeking and what you know of that community, I always recommend avoiding medical jargon and speaking really plainly. One good rule of thumb, I call it the grandma rule, is if you wouldn't use the same language to your grandma at a holiday dinner, then it's too complicated. It has to be something that is going to be readable at any education level, so that any patient can have access to that information. I also think listening is a pretty large part of the work we do as well. You want to listen to the community, learn the language that they use, and then reflect that back to them in the materials that we create. For instance, I have one patient community that uses care partners, not caregivers, because they're partners in the care. It's not always just giving that they're doing for for a patient, for instance, that has family members. Often they're called caregivers, the people who are taking care of them or supporting them in their journey. And this community prefers care partners because they're partners in this person's care. So that's the language we use when we're creating materials. Also, visuals are really important. The visuals that reflect the diversity of the experiences and the people. It's critically important. There's actually a vast lack of representation in clinical trials today. 75% of clinical trial participants are white. And the way we message, not only in our language, but in our imagery, will impact who the messages resonate with. And it's important that we do increase that. So I think those are some small steps we can make. But I think the most important thing is that connection with the patient community and soliciting feedback from them often on their experience, and then constantly improving from phase one to phase two and adapting as you go.
Got it. So I was interested by, okay, the caregivers, care partners. Could you just unpack that one more time? Because that was interesting to me, especially coming from a communications perspective and writing copy. It was the partners is going to be somebody who is someone who I would call a caregiver that's working alongside with a family in conjunction. Correct. Is that how we use that?
That's exactly right. And I think it's similar to thinking about it's the intentionality of language around not people, you know, you don't have diabetics, you have people with living with diabetes, right? And so it's centering the people in the conversation and not necessarily the needs of the population or their diagnosis, and mm-hmm. talking about a little bit more of a holistic view.
I like it. I like it. Have you had to change the messaging you use at a time when it's harder for investors to access capital? Because obviously interest rates right now are things are a bit tougher. And I would assume, now this is just a layman, that when you're going into a big R&D process, you're going to have to bundle up a bunch of cash to go through this whole thing when there's a big chance of the drug failing. But also you have a whole bunch of interest on one side of it. How do you communicate things or change the messaging around products and services? And
Yeah, it's a great question. I think understanding that timeline to actual market of 10 to 15 years for most drugs is really important, because investors become a critical audience when there's no way to actually generate revenue for biotechs when they're in those early stages. So messaging in our current market is really important. It's, of course, always important, but mm-hmm. but right now is very important to make sure that what you're saying is helping you stand out and resonate with the audiences that you're looking to meet, particularly investors. First, a lot of biotechs in the last year to 18 months have experienced a lot of layoffs. A lot are looking to extend their capital runways. So some of that is through layoffs. Some of it's through prioritizing their pipeline to focus on their most promising assets, the ones that are furthest along, or the ones that have the most potential for the market. A lot of messaging around these really significant changes are designed to help companies weather this market. So helping to talk about how these structural changes are going to help them survive this bear market. The second is messaging that looks to the future. And we're messaging early and often on the catalysts and the value drivers, those data readouts from clinical trials, the regulatory milestones with the FDA and European regulatory bodies that serve as these key inflection points for investors. Those are value creation points where there might be a catalyst to fundraise on. So making that roadmap very clear that when you expect to hit those milestones, what you expect those milestones to look like, updating on progress often, and then execution becomes critically important, and then communicating around when you hit those milestones, making sure that there's a lot of deep understanding of the value that that creates for your organization and how it helps propel you towards your ultimate goal, which is to reach patients.
So communication is really key at this time and in stage, given the current state of the economy.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Let's change topics a little bit. So as a founding member of the Harvard Medical School LGBT Advisory Committee, what are the issues in that community that need the most attention these days?
Yeah, so I'll start by saying that I'm not quite as closely connected to the community these days. But that said, every hospital, care delivery system, medical training and education institution in this country is facing attacks against the provisions of trans and gender diverse care across the board. So I have to say the attacks lack medical or scientific grounding and have had devastating impacts on the LGBTQ plus community. Hate crimes and based on gender identity have gone up by 32% from 2021 to 2022 alone, according to the FBI. And last year, the Human Rights Campaign declared a national state of emergency for LGBTQ plus Americans for the first time in its history. Wow. So that's a state of emergency in America for LGBTQ plus Americans living within this country. The attacks are not only dangerous, they're unfounded. Transgender and gender diverse care is not only affirming, it is life-saving. There are evidence-based guidelines backed by decades of research and supported by every major medical association, which represents over about 1.5 million doctors in the U.S. alone. So without question, every medical community and healthcare institution has a responsibility to protect and promote this life-saving care, and Harvard Medical School certainly has a role in that. So I think that's the biggest issue facing any medical institution for the LGBTQ plus community at this time.
The institutions obviously are supportive of this type of care. You have a certain amount of rumble of public outrage because of it. Mm-hmm. Are the institutions kind of shirking away a little bit to avoid controversy, or have they held up at a time of intense kind of scrutiny?
I think the answer to that is as diverse as how many institutions there are in the country. I think one of the biggest threats is the legislation that is actually being passed that is limiting the ability of these institutions, even should they want to provide these provisions of care. So there are a number of states across this country, and there have been hundreds of pieces of legislation introduced that are designed expressly to limit this medical care. And unfortunately, in a lot of parts of this country, medical institutions' hands are tied because they have been prohibited from providing this care. So it's a very unique response based on where you are in the country, what you're legally allowed to do, and where your leadership stands on it. But I would say that at least in the Boston area where I'm based and where Harvard Medical School is, we see a lot of support from the healthcare institutions here, a lot of education opportunities to try to advance trans and gender diverse care, but it's certainly something that is under attack.
Right, definitely. I was just thinking from a communications perspective, is it possible for communications professionals, people who talk about these issues publicly, is there a way to change the messaging that will kind of reduce the heat on this type of, pushback against gender diverse care? Or is it something that is just so kind of hardwired into a certain type of American politics that an educational campaign might be hard to undo it?
What's hard is the data out there. The data clearly show, as I said, there's a lot of medical and scientific backing for this type of care, and the data clearly show that. I think there are a lot of people much smarter than me that are trying to solve some of these problems. And I think when it comes to bias and fear, frankly, fear mongering, it's a consistently hard message to cut through when facts and feelings have the same weight. That's a hard battle to win.
Thanks. That was good. Let's go with the big topic of the day, which is artificial intelligence. And has AI made any significant impacts when it comes to the comms side of the biotech industry?
Yeah, I think biotech communications professionals, like the rest of us, are still trying to figure out what AI means for us, what place it has in our work. Luckily, AI has been in biotech and in healthcare for a long time. It's been used to help identify therapeutic targets and help advance drug discovery for a very long time. So there is, in our industry, some real awareness of AI and machine learning, not to mention in digital health tools, it is quite prevalent. But as we think about our work, I worry a lot about bias that's built into these systems, and particularly when you think about patients and that type of messaging, so much of the inputs in our systems are already built upon bias. So I worry about perpetuating that. I think the potential at this stage for most biotech communications professionals lies in eliminating a lot of the repeatable tasks that we do every day and ensuring that everyone is working at the top of their license and is able to do work that feels meaningful and valuable to them. But I think it's one of those things that if you ask me again in 3 weeks, my answer might change. There's always, you know, there's always something new coming out. And I think a lot of us are keeping very close eyes on this and trying to figure out what the guardrails are and how to operate within this system in an ethical and reasonable way.
Great, great. Well, thank you so much, Megan, for coming on the PR 360 podcast. What's the call to action here? How do people follow you? How can people learn more about the work you're doing?
Sure. Thank you. So I am on LinkedIn at Megan Prof. McGrath. You can also find me at McDougall Advisors, which is the consulting firm that I work at that specializes in biotech, public health, digital health type clients. And you can connect with me in any of those ways. And I would love to hear from all of you. Thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you so much, Megan. And best of luck.
Thank you. You too.
PR 360 was produced by Todd Perry in partnership with Global Results Communications. Be sure to subscribe to the show and leave a review wherever you get podcasts. Follow GRC on all socials at Global Results. Follow Todd on Twitter at Todd A. Perry. That's Todd with one D. Talk to you next week.